Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Behind the Curtain today with a political pulse. This is WGN-TV's Paul Listick, and very excited to have joining me this week and next week, Chris Matthews. It's a name you know well from television, from journalism, best-selling author of the book Hardball, and now he is out with an autobiography called This Country, My Life in Politics and History. Chris, we're going to talk about the book, talk about your life, because it obviously informed all the decisions you made. But with your permission, we need to talk about the political landscape first.
Sure.
So let me start the question on so many people's minds around the country, not so much in Illinois, because voting rights are pretty open here and unchallenged, but it is a national issue. So your take on this, I mean, you've got states like Texas saying, we're giving people more time to vote. We want to just be sure there's no fraud. And, of course, you have a lot of people saying, no, you're attacking our sacred rights as Americans. What's the proper way for people to look at this?
Well, the normal political operation is to get out the vote. That is what both parties have done for a couple of centuries now, get your people to the polls. This move by the Republican Party and all these legislatures is to reduce the number of people who go to the polls, by making it more difficult, by requiring different documentation. Anything that reduces the number of voters seems to be the goal here, and that's new in politics, I think. Although there is, of course, that awful history of poll taxes and literacy tests, which were used to reduce the participation by newly freed slaves, basically, and their families. But clearly this is going on. It's about politics. It's about getting your advantage. I think the Republican Party does feel some pressure demographically. They feel that the new Americans or the people that are just getting involved politically are not going to vote for them. And I'm not sure that's a good long-term strategy, because I do believe that immigrants from below the border are going to gradually become more Republican. They're more religious in many ways. They are very much self-reliant. They don't like socialism, but because of where they came from. So there's a lot of reasons why someone like of that background would end up being a Republican over time. But in the short run, I think they believe that they're not going to be Republican, and African-American voters are not going to be Republican. And so they go after things like souls to the polls on Sunday and early voting of any kind. And I don't think that's the right direction to go. I wouldn't mind if they go to the rule of you have to have an ID card of some kind, whether it's your fuel bill, your electric bill, whatever, but some evidence that you are who you claim to be, without saying to the people you have to go downtown, take X many subway rides to find some Department of Transportation facility where you can get your photo ID card. I think that is onerous.
Texas, obviously, as we speak now, the House of Representatives, Democrats, have gone off to Washington, D.C. They've left town. It's interesting that Governor Abbott basically calls them hypocrites, because he said they're basically filibustering the Texas legislature while they're off to, you know, beg Congress or the Senate to get rid of the federal filibuster. You're saying, are they essentially just postponing the inevitable? In other words, this Texas law is going to pass now, a month from now, or 6 months from now?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, Paul. That's the way I read it. And I read that in the New York Times today, and I think that's seems to be a reasonable, it's a stalling tactic, unfortunately, because I think there is a resolution here that you can come up with something in the middle here where you say things like ID cards, okay, yeah, but we're also going to have voting on Sunday, and because of the black tradition there for the churches. We can find ways where everybody's going to say, okay, that's a pretty good compromise. I don't think the Democrats are that restrained either, though, when they throw in things like we want to senators from the District of Columbia, and we want statehood for the District of Columbia, and we want public financing of campaigns. Well, those are bridges too far for the middle of the road Republican, even, or maybe the more moderate Democrat. So I don't know whether those are bargaining chips or what, but clearly the Republicans are never going to ever vote for that bill.
And by the way, what do you think the fate is on in the U.S. Senate, the Joe Manchin's, the Kirsten Sinemas. I mean, it just doesn't look like it's going anywhere, although maybe they get some work with Joe Manchin. I don't know. He doesn't seem to think so.
Well, he says, I'm not adamantly a no vote. I'm not adamantly a no vote. But, you know, I bumped into him in a restaurant a couple weeks ago in Washington, and he's basically voting his state. He's voting West Virginia as if he were governor. He's just saying, this is the position of my state. They voted almost 40% margin for Trump. I'm not going to go the other way. And I think, look, AOC would say the same thing about her district. You can't ignore the voters back home, you know.
And I've said that on our own WGN air in Chicago, which is to say, it raises the question, is Joe Manchin supposed to be the conscience of Democrats around the country, or is he supposed to vote what his people in West Virginia would say? I think you and I would both agree Joe Manchin may be the only Democrat who's electable in West Virginia, and for him to do
That's something true.
That the party there wouldn't want, he's done.
The problem is that I was just doing through the math a while ago. There's 21 states in the union who are ruby red right now. That means that the Democrats by themselves will never get 60 votes for anything. They will not have 60 senators. It's not going to happen. And so they have to recognize either they get rid of the filibuster or they find something that 10 Republicans will join them with, or many Republicans will join them with. And that they haven't been able to do it. That's just the facts we're living with right now. So there's all kinds of – I also do not believe that there's only two Democratic senators opposed to getting rid of the filibuster. We have not tested this yet. We have not had some for a show of hands or an IRNA vote. And I think there's a handful in there somewhere that is not ready to get rid of the filibuster, and they haven't exposed themselves yet.
And let's say the Democrats decide to do what they typically do, which is to sort of take the weak road out. They don't do it. Do you have any doubt that Mitch McConnell, if he gains power again in 2022, do you have any doubt that he'll get rid of the filibuster for whatever issues he needs and justify to the world, just as he did with the Supreme Court nominations? We can't give you 11 months for Merrick Garland, but hey, we got 5 seconds to do a replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I don't think he'll go that far. I think he wants the legislative veto. Maybe because I have an insight on that, but I do have something of an insight, okay. And I think he does have an institutional commitment on that one. I think he did it on Supreme Court judge nominations, but I don't think he'll give it up on the legislative veto. You know, Republicans are almost institutionally against legislation. They don't want to pass a bunch of bills. They're not activists.
Okay.
He doesn't want a busy U.S. Senate. He wants to have an obstructionist U.S. Senate. That's what I think.
Well, then let's talk. Then we talk about the other legislature they're dealing with right now, the infrastructure bills. Obviously, there's the bipartisan bill. And now, again, as we talk, the $3.5 trillion bill, essentially from Democrats, that's going to work its way through the human infrastructure piece of this. What's your thought? Does the second bill kill the first bill? Because Republicans, they've said, Mitch McConnell has said, or others have said, you try and give me a larger, at this point, $3.5 trillion bill, I won't vote for that first one.
Well, that was a mistake that the president made in the first 2 hours after he introduced the bipartisan proposal. And that made it seem to me, if I were a Republican senator, that if I voted for the first bipartisan measure, that I would be, by implication, voting for the second. Once the president said, I'll only sign both of these together. I think once that happened, you're telling a Republican senator, you're in cahoots with us. And I think that wasn't going to sell. So he's separated the two of them. I don't think Pelosi has separated the two. I think she's still talking about taking both bills to the president at the same time. Look, I'm not sure. I'm not just sure they'll get 50 votes in the Senate for the second package. How about that? I don't think we're arguing about something that's speculative, because I don't think that second package is going to be that edible, if you will, by people like Manchin and Sinema. I'm not sure they're going to vote for him.
You have to give Republicans credit, though, for with the last COVID relief bill. None of them voted for it, but then they go home and they all tweet and they send messages out, basically letting their constituents know all the money they're bringing to the district. I'll give McConnell credit. At least when it came to the infrastructure bill, he said, hey, I'm going to get $4 billion for Kentucky, but I didn't vote for this thing.
Back when I worked for six years as administrative assistant to Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and we were arguing about a battle over an infrastructure bill at the time, right before the 82 election. And I called up the chief engineer of Peoria, Illinois, and asked them for, he gave me the whole list of bridges in Peoria that were below safety code. And the speaker went on the floor of the House. I didn't think he'd do this. And he walked down into the well where they speak, and he just listed out all of those bridges below safety code in the city of the minority leader, the Republican leader of the House of Representatives, Bob Michael, his friend. And, boy, that was the way to do it. The trouble with the Democrats is they talk about, they let the topic be the cost of the bill and sort of an abstract notion of infrastructure, when, in fact, what they should be doing is talking about particular public facilities, roads, tunnels, whatever, that are in trouble, that are rickety or dangerous, and school buses will be going over them today at 3 o'clock, and you better fix them at some point, or you're going to be responsible. They're not really taking the argument to the tangible reality of why people do fix bridges. Why do people? Why is this a first world country where we fix up our public facilities, where in a third world country or a fourth world country, everything is just getting worse and worse and dumpier and uglier because they never fix anything? And I think that should be, they should be much more aggressive in taking the fight to the states and the senators who are holding out. That's what I think would work, actually.
And we'll see how that plays out. The other sort of relevant piece that of legislation that Congress is dealing with, you write about, actually that last story you told is in your book as well. I love that in the book. But you talk about race being the San Andreas fault of politics. And what is your sense as we move towards 2022, this whole concept of defund the police, which some Democrats call for, but really not a lot. And I don't really think it's the message they're trying to send anyway. But Republicans are very good at rallying that people around the defund the police call. That going to cost Democrats in 2022?
Well, and also, I was talking to a political consultant in Philadelphia recently, and he told me that right before, 3 weeks before the 2020 election, the Republicans began running that ad about defund the police in the Philadelphia area. And they were able to win re-election for Brian Fitzpatrick in Bucks County, who was in trouble before that. And Van Drew, that congressman who had shifted parties from Democrat to Republican, he got re-elected against that Kennedy candidate, Patrick Kennedy's wife. And so that is a fiery issue. I assume now, based upon those successes, that the Republicans will run defund the police attacks on the whole idea of defunding police everywhere they can. And that's why I think Jim Clyburn, he's probably the most respected African-American member of Congress, has gone up to run against that progressive candidate who is still in that category of being generally for defund the police, I believe, or at least associated with that, to make sure that the leadership of the Congress is clearly not on board with defund the police, because they know it's a big loser. Look at Eric Adams elected in New York City, or nominated. He's an ex-cop. That's the thing that people know about him. He's an ex-cop. That sent a big message to me that the Democrats are wising up to this concern about safety.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. We have to talk about Trump. I can't let you go and not talk about that while I'm with you. And a lot of discussion whether Trump has been the problem of society or a symptom of the problem. I fall on the side of being sort of symptomatic that people are just very frustrated with the system, with all the rules, everything that we live with. If Trump were to decide not to run, I mean, do the problem goes away if Trump goes away? Because Republicans clearly are, the 2016 or the 2020 platform. We have no platform. Whatever Trump wants is our platform.
Look, you're where I'm at. I think Trumpism preceded him. I think he confected it and put a lot of things together, like anti-immigration, some racial aspect to it about the birtherism issue. He exploited that. I think the pro-gun, the pro-life positions were all there to be adopted by anybody. He put them all together in a way that, and he also was this tycoon who was Mr. Success with the beautiful wife and the big buildings, the gold buildings, and he looked to a lot of people like Success and establishment even. And when he gave his okay to all these divisive issues, he put the imprimatur on them and made them very sellable. So I don't think he created any of this stuff, but he knew how to use it. And I think we'll see a Trumpian candidate in 2024. It may be DeSantis of Florida. I don't know. I think their ticket's probably going to end up being DeSantis and Nikki Haley, so they can get the Trumpian for support and the neocon or hawkish support. The only thing missing in that is the evangelical. I don't know who will make that case. That's a big part of their it's a coalition party. It's evangelicals. It's hawks. It's tough people in immigration issues, the social issues. Trump was managing, succeeded. If he hadn't blown COVID, he might have done it again. He could have won it again. He was very close.
I said that.
He should be saying
that's
that.
Right.
He ought to say to himself, as I almost won it again. I won it once. I near did it the second under the worst possible conditions against a moderate candidate. I give me credit for that instead of lying about having won.
I think you're right. At the beginning of COVID, when he talked about himself as a wartime president and the invisible enemy, I mean, I thought that was brilliant because, again, this country, as a rule, does not throw out wartime presidents at a second term. I thought that was the direction he was going to take, and then things just went the other way. Let's talk about the media. You are the media. You've been the media for decades. And now, of course, you know, with Tucker and Sean and Laura Ingraham, once again, their power. I'm one of those people who believes that if Fox News, Newsmax had been around in the Nixon days, Nixon would have had a second term. I'm sorry, not a second term, but Nixon would never have resigned.
Well, it's, you know, I don't know if you're old enough like I can. I can tell you, if you don't have a medium to push out your message all the time, you're going to have a hard time mattering politically. Back in the 60s and earlier before that was a newspaper in New York called the New York Herald Tribune. It was moderate Republican. And when they went, the moderate Republican whole faction disappeared. The liberals had the New York Times. The more conservatives had the Wall Street Journal. But when you lost the Herald Tribune, you lost that moderate Republican Senate, the Rockefeller people, the Javits people, all the Northeastern and Midwestern Republican, mostly Northeastern. And that's gone. So without Fox, I don't know. I agree. I think without a voice nightly at 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, it's very hard to sustain a political movement. But Tucker and Laura, I know Laura better, and Sean I know a little bit. They're trumpeting the Trump cause, and that's why it's continuing. I mean, if they weren't doing it, I'm not sure he alone, without Twitter and without Facebook, would be able to do it.
I think you're right. Of course, on the other side, with MSNBC, which you were a part of for decades, and you know, now there's Rachel and Lawrence and all the folks that you know, it seems to me that the folks on Fox have a greater impact on their following. And I don't know if it moves beyond the base and beyond the following. People like you and me, I mean, I watch all the shows. I watch everything on Fox, everything on MSNBC, everything on CNN. I need to know what everybody is saying so I can do my job. But that being said, it seems as though they're able to really rile up their base more so than the approach of the more liberal MSNBC folks. Agree?
Yeah, I think the right is angrier, more angry at the world right now, the direction of the world, demographically, in terms of wokeness, all that sort of thing. They're angry at so many things. They're concerned about their guns being taken from them. They're very angry, and maybe certainly they have the right to be, about abortion. They don't like the gay rights success, I don't think. There's so many things that disturb them about modern times that's not hard to ignite their anger every night at 9 o'clock. The liberals, the thing about the liberals is they, progressives, more traditional liberals are wider in their concerns, but not as emotional. They tend to be focused on things they care about, but they don't have this daily anger that can be stoked effectively. There's a different temperament there. I think maybe they're more successful, they're better educated, and I'm not praising them for this, but they've benefited from higher educations in many cases, and that has soothed them because they're more confident in making it in our society. If you got a college degree, you're a lot more confident than someone without one. If you have a master's degree or a doctorate or something, or you're a lawyer or something, you're just much more confident of life in America in the 21st century. This is just a fact, and it's logical. I mean, a guy who works in a factory, semi-skilled, he's obviously worried about being replaced by a machine. I mean, look at, my God, you can't go through an airport and not see what's going on, where every single job is replaced by a machine. And you have to go to a restaurant, you have to learn how to use a desktop to get a hamburger. But there's a guy that, or a woman that's not working there that day because of that machine. So I think a lot of it's that. I think it's a lot of it's economics.
And so the Democrats, who of course were, you know, since the Johnson days, the party of labor and the common man and the working class, which you relate to so well. And then, you know, in many ways, Trump comes in, flips that on its head. I mean, here's one of the richest guys in the country, more or less, who basically convinces the working class he's their guy. And Biden is seen as the socialist, but for some reason, Trump not seen as the autocrat. And when you had Trump on your show as part of your college tour, and you got Trump to admit that when it came to abortion, yes, women need to be punished if they have one, you would think that would do him in, But once again, that says to me there's something in the environment that went beyond Trump, beyond Biden, beyond all the players.
I think it's unspoken anger by a white working class, and I mean working class, people who go to work and do their jobs and look out for their kids, that they can't pay for tuition for college because it just inflated like mad, the price of college. I mean, it's just, I mean, I went to Holy Cross for $2,000 a year, and now it's 70-some thousand dollars. I mean, this isn't just regular inflation. This has galloped up to this level, and it's changed the ability to even to borrow the money. And that's just changed people's hopes. I'll tell you, there's a friend of mine from Pittsburgh. I worked in, I was in the Peace Corps with him. He had the greatest line in the world. He said, people don't mind being used. They mind being discarded. And I think that's the way a lot of white working class people feel about the Democratic Party, that they discarded them.
And Biden tries to bring them back. We'll see. I want to turn to some issues. You mentioned these, but I want to focus on for a little bit in this show, which is LGBTQ rights versus religious freedom. You know, you talk about what Republicans aren't comfortable with, Democrats are. But here's the thing. As you know, most of these things now are coming out of eventually the Supreme Court. You're a foster parent organization. You don't want to rent to same-sex foster same-sex couples. That's fine with us. You don't want to bake a cake for gay couples. Well, we're going to send that back down for revisiting it. But if it comes back up, we'll probably respect the baker. Obviously, with the replacement of Justice Ginsburg with Justice Barrett, the notion of religious freedom, to me, is going to clearly win the day when it comes to challenges, especially from the LGBTQ community.
Well, I think with this court, yes. That's clearly, it surprised me. There was a unanimous vote the other day and about the religious exception, and I think we're seeing where the it's very flexible, to put it lightly, between this and the Warren Court years ago, and which direction. It does matter who wins elections. It matters who gets to pick the Supreme Court. And this one with, six Catholic members, you know, who are, I think, to a large extent, that share the values of their church, of my church. And I understand what's going on. I can see it.
A lot of pressure on Breyer to retire. Doesn't look like he's going to. By my calculation, he technically has one more year where he could serve and still be replaced by Biden, unless somebody in the Senate, one of the older folks, because a Democrat is would pass away or resign or retire in a state where there's a Republican governor.
Yeah, and
Breyer can do what he wants. What's that?
It could happen. I mean, things happen. People die. But I guess he's...
So is Breyer making a mistake?
Breyer. I don't think he's putting pressure on him.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Agree. Okay. On the abortion issue, again, a case coming back up. 15 weeks will probably be the new number that the Supreme Court will look and say that's not an undue burden. Then Texas and some other states will send 6 weeks up. And, of course, Texas adds on. And, by the way, if you turn somebody in who's had an abortion, it's $10,000 for you if you're successful. I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's a University of Michigan professor. She thinks Roe versus Wade gets overturned. I say I don't think it does. I think they whittle it away with each of these things.
John Roberts, just say it's not. John Roberts is not going to preside or have his name on a majority opinion that overturns Roe v. Wade. That Roe v. Wade decision, whatever we think of it morally, religiously, or in terms of the Constitution, was a very politically informed decision. It took what most people take as common sense, that the further the pregnancy goes on, the more that becomes a human being, or at some point becomes a human being. And that's when you have to have a social protection of it. I'm a normal person. I hear women who are pregnant who say, my baby just kicked me. Well, they never say, my fetus just kicked me. You know, there's just a basic human instinct at a point. At some point, it's a human being. My wife's had three children by C-section. They're in there. You know, and if they're late, three blanks like Michael was, it's very hard to say to yourself, Michael wasn't Michael, you know, a minute or two before they took him out. It's very hard to say that to yourself. I mean, I'm talking human nature here about the way we look at things. And so, you know, I've always been for Roe v. Wade. I just think it was anyway, there's never a great decision in life. Oftentimes you take something that isn't the worst. You take something short of the worst, and you go, this is better than wide open abortion on demand, so-called, and it's, of course, it's better than outlawing it, too. A lot of times people don't understand the consequence of what they do. For example, if you're a Republican and you restrict the right to vote and you send a message to millions of Americans, minority people, that they're not really part of the country, they're not really citizens, they're not worthy of having a point of view politically, you're telling them they're not Americans. There's going to be a social reaction to that that you don't want to know about how horrible it'll be. And if you outlaw abortion, you're going to deal with the situation of people getting them illegally and without safety precautions and not by doctors, and you have to live with that consequence too. And people always push for what they want, and they never say, wait a minute, what will happen if I get what I want?
Let me, a couple of questions left as we look at the political landscape. You've identified Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley as call them upcomers, if you, Nikki Haley, right? My question is, on the Democratic side, who should Democrats be looking for to emerge?
Well, I think Kamala Harris will have a real challenge somewhere along the line if she's running, if Biden decides to limit it to one term. We don't know what condition he'll be in, first of all. You don't know how he'll feel about his condition or what he'll look like in terms of his condition. But he will be older, 3 years older than now. And he has to make that decision 2 years from now in early 2023. He has to make the decision well ahead of the election. And he may want to make that decision based upon whether Trump's running or not. If he sees Trump running, he may say, I don't think Kamala can defeat Trump, so I better run to beat Trump. I'm thinking it's like almost like a real card game. You have to think what the other side's going to do. Now, I don't know who Gavin Newsom in California, the governor, he's probably going to beat the recall. I mean, I think there's going to be some he would be a logical candidate if you're going to challenge Kamala, if somebody does. But it's really not a good bench right now in the Republican Party, in sports terms. I don't see a bench. I don't see a lot of really good candidates on the verge of being presidential candidates out there. Maybe Klobuchar again. Maybe Buttigieg. I can see Buttigieg wanting to be president and being a good candidate. And that shows real change in our culture, that a gay man can be a real threat, really, as a presidential candidate.
Yeah, I think he gets his day. It's not quite yet, but he's an incredibly bright guy. And finally, just this is, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit with this one, which is to say 2022, history tells us Republicans gain back certainly the House. Does history come through here, or are dynamics so messed up, who knows what's going to happen?
Well, 36 of the last 39 cases, that's what happened. I think that plus the fact that, I just think the redistricting power of the Republican Party in some 20 states where they have the governorship and the legislature. They are in such tremendous strength to put together their reapportionment pattern that I've got to give them the strong edge here. On the Senate side, it's really hard to see much movement. It's this True North seems to be for a while now 50-50. Somewhere our country is so balanced between whatever else, and the Trump strength plus the Republican strength besides Trump. So if you're a Republican candidate, you get the Trumpites working for you, voting for you, and you also get the regular Republicans voting for you and some of the independents. So you're in pretty good shape to win the Senate race. I think Ohio is probably going Republican. I think Pennsylvania may be up in the air. Fetterman, the lieutenant governor, might win it. But then again, the Republicans, I don't think they have a candidate yet. But there's not many races that are really wide open. Perhaps Georgia, maybe Arizona. Not many seats that are really, truly 50-50 right now.
Yeah. Final question, Chris. Everybody loves to talk about the Founding Fathers, and they support everybody, whoever's talking, their mind. If the Founding Fathers came back today and looked down on our country, what would they say? What would they think of their experiment?
Well, I hope they'd say pretty much this is what we wanted. They would be surprised at the number of minorities. They'd be surprised at the role of women. Obviously, they weren't included in the Constitution, neither women nor minorities, African Americans. They'd probably be surprised at how liberal we are. That's sure. But if they came to Washington and they saw our buildings, they saw the Congress operating and people voting and showing up and behaving pretty well and really arguing about issues that are important, I think they'd be very proud of what they put together back in the 1780s.
That's what I think. And I hope this thing will be true 250 years from now, Paul.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll be here talking about it.
If we come back in 250 years and we're still basically as we are as a democracy, not like the French in our Fifth Republic, but still with our First Republic, and still holding elections every 2 years for Congress and every 4 years for president. If that's still true, I think they'd be quite happy.
Chris, this will bring to the end part one of our discussion. Chris Matthews' new book is This Country, My Life in Politics and History. We've obviously got a lot of people excited, I think, from this political discussion. People probably want to and need to know more about you. And so joining on the next podcast next week is Chris Matthews, the author of This Country. Chris, thanks for being with me on the Political Issues Show. Hang with me because we're about to talk about your life.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.